Good afternoon, everyone. Welcome, welcome to the Center for American Progress. My name is John Halpin, and my partner here, Rui Teixeira, and I are the co-directors of the Progressive Studies Program here at CAP. And on behalf of the Progressive Studies Program and Campus Progress, I want to welcome you to today's discussion about some what we think is pretty interesting data, a big national study on the ideology, political attitudes, and beliefs of young people, as well as some examination of the longer demographic trends among the millennial generation. Just briefly, the Progressive Studies Program that Rui and I run here was started a few months ago, and it's primarily divided into two basic programs. One is an examination of the history and intellectual foundations of progressivism, and the other part is an examination of the public's understanding of progressivism, and that's most of what we're going to be focusing on today. I'm going to present briefly the results of a major national study conducted in conjunction with a larger national study of all Americans. This is specifically of those age 18 to 29, what we broadly call the millennial generation. I'm going to give you some overview of those findings. And then Rui's going to present his work on the demographic and attitudinal trends and patterns among this same generation, to give you a better perspective of the types of things that are occurring in American politics and what we can expect going forward. Both of us want to thank Carl Agnew and David Madlin, who helped us with these reports and were co-authors. Also want to thank the great folks at Campus Progress and CAP for putting together this event. And we also want to offer special thanks to the Glaser Progress Foundation in Seattle, who supports all the work we do with the Progressive Studies Program. Now, let me briefly, I'm going to have our panelists and respondents stand up real quick. We have Abby Kisa from Circle, and Erica Williams from Campus Progress. Let me give you some brief information about those two. Abby is the youth coordinator and researcher at Circle, which is a great acronym that stands for, correct me if I'm wrong, the Center for Information and Research on Civic Learning and Engagement at Tufts.
It actually comes up before the Wikipedia entry on the geometric circle now. It's like at the top.
So that's some good Google bombing there. Works out pretty well. It's a national research center that focuses on young people's civic education and engagement. Abby serves as a liaison to practitioner organizations across the country. She led the research and writing of Circle's national study recently of college student political engagement called Millennials Talk Politics, and is currently working on a large project focused on young people who do not yet have college experience. Prior to her tenure at Circle, she helped organize students around the country as part of a national campaign at Campus Compact to increase student involvement in public life. She was the co-editor of a report there called Raise Your Voice, a student guide to making positive social change. She also serves on the steering committee of IMPACT, the National Student Conference on Service, Advocacy, and Social Action. She's on the board of directors of Breakaway and is currently a graduate student in American Studies at the University of Maryland. Erica is the deputy director of Campus Progress here at the Center for American Progress, and she's a frequent analyst and commentator on the political empowerment of the millennial generation. At Campus Progress, Erica leads the organization in working with and for young people to help implement national campaigns on a range of core progressive policy areas involving economic mobility, civil rights, healthcare, equal opportunity, and climate change. Before joining Campus and CAP, Erica was the field associate at the Leadership Conference on Civil Rights, working on grassroots strategies in 45 states around civil and human rights legislation. Erica is the 2008 O Magazine Women Rule Leadership winner, a former Aspen Institute fellow, and a graduate of the University of Maryland as well. So we have a University of Maryland contingency on our panel today. Let me just briefly tell you a little bit about the survey real quick, and then I'll turn it over to Rui. The basic storyline that we find in this research is one of conservative decline and progressive ascendancy among the millennial generation. It may not strike you as surprising, but the evidence is quite clear in this survey. The formative years for many millennials were the past 8 years of the Bush administration, and it's quite clear that that was a searing experience for many young people. It soured them on many core conservative ideas and opened them up to a lot of progressive ones. Younger Americans expressed broad and deep support for a progressive vision embodied in President Obama and his agenda. And just as Generation X, which is my generation, broke quite heavily for Ronald Reagan and conservatives in the early 80s and through the 90s, it's quite conceivable that the millennial generation could prove to be a quite powerful progressive force in American politics over the next 10 to 20 years, if not longer. If I could please turn your attention to the handout here. I'm going to talk briefly about some of the overall trends in the survey and then present a few slides. What you have in front of you here is the core of the survey we conducted, and it's basically responses to 40 statements that we created that are broken up evenly between progressive and conservative ideas. We wanted to have a fairly parsimonious methodology that was based on affirmative ideas from both sides and find out what type of consensus or agreement or disagreement we could find on each of these ideas. As you'll see going through this list, the ideological beliefs with the greatest consensus and most intensity of support are predominantly progressive ones. More than 2 in 3 younger Americans agree with progressive perspectives on energy, sustainable living, and climate change, government efforts to protect people and the economy, and new steps to fight inequality. Strength of agreement, that's the more intense sentiments in this direction, top 40% on many of these measures. And many of these areas of agreement among younger Americans were also seen in our national survey, particularly around energy issues and some of the economic ones. What's also striking, if you go through this table, is the lower level of support for conservative ideas at this point. Of the 21 statements that we tested in this survey, with at least a majority of younger Americans agreeing with those statements, only 4 can be classified as conservative. One is a broadly supported idea that's an old line conservative isolationist perspective about doing more at home as opposed to doing things abroad. That's something we see across all age cohorts. But the other 3 that enjoy some majority support involve Social Security, the importance of trade, and a conservative attack on spending. But overall, we find fairly weak support, ambivalence, and outright skepticism about many conservative teachings. Agreement ranges from only 44 to 50% on many key conservative ideas about deficits, limited government, and tax cuts. You can see that on the second page. What's important to note here is that in contrast to our national study, younger Americans are much more ambivalent and skeptical about these core conservative teachings than our older Americans. Another interesting trend you see throughout this that you don't see necessarily in the national survey is that majorities of self-identified young conservatives and Republicans agree with every progressive position on the role of government. It's quite an astounding finding in some ways. They also agree with 4 out of 5 progressive positions on economic and domestic policy and 3 out of 5 progressive beliefs about international affairs and national security. So overall, even the most conservative elements of the millennial generation are much more in alignment with certain progressive ideas than those who are older. There are some key differences here between those who are younger and older, and I'll just highlight these fairly quickly. On the cultural front, not surprisingly, younger Americans are not in line with much of the conservative cultural agenda. Far fewer younger Americans than older ones agree that changes in the traditional family have harmed society, while many more younger Americans than older ones believe that the country has gone too far in mixing politics and religion. On the national security front, I think the effects of the Bush years have been quite dramatic. Far fewer younger Americans than older ones are willing to agree that military force is the most effective way to keep America safe, that restrictions on civil liberties and torture are okay in order to protect the United States from terrorism, or that it's unpatriotic to criticize your leaders in the military during the time of war. Younger Americans reject most of these ideas. On the economic front, I think the collapse of the economy has also had a pretty significant impact on younger Americans. You have younger Americans are much more likely than older ones to agree that the government must step in to protect the national economy when the market fails. And they're also more likely to worry about economic inequality and the gap between rich and poor. And they're less likely than older Americans to believe core conservative notions that stronger regulation of business does more harm than good, and that free market solutions are better than government, or that limited government is always better than big government. So again, what you see throughout the core of the survey here is a story of progressive ascendancy and significant skepticism or challenge for the conservative worldview. Now, when we add all these together, what we've done with this survey is try to create something that we can track over time. And we've created a composite measure of ideology for both the population at large and for the millennial generation. And again, based on these 40 questions, what we did, we have a 0 to 10 scale, and it's just a pure additive measure based on people's scores to the 40 questions. We are able to calculate a cumulative score and specific ones broken out by subject area. And so if you look in the third column here, you can see that the overall composite ideology measure for those in the millennial generation is 221.6. And if you think of 200 as roughly the middle point, this makes younger folks solidly progressive. And as you can see, compared to the older folks, those 30 and older, markedly more progressive. What's interesting, when you look down the breakdown under that column, younger folks are most progressive on cultural values and beliefs and the role of government, and they're least progressive, but still progressive on economic and domestic policy, primarily because they agree with many conservative ideas on Social Security and trade. You'll also notice, moving across the bottom there, that the youngest part of the millennial generation is also the most progressive, and that steadily changes as you move forward. This may be a little difficult for people to read. What's also interesting here, we then calculate the mean scores for all the various demographic groups within the millennial generation. And as you can see here, this is fairly consistent with our national survey. The range of opinion is actually quite truncated, and it's even more so among young people than among older voters. The farthest, most conservative point, which is a group of conservative Republicans, comes in at 179.1, and the most progressive to liberal are self-identified liberal Democrats at 245.9. What's interesting, if you can see that the smaller gray dots under the conservative part there, is that millennial groupings are markedly more progressive than their same counterparts in the population at large. You can see that their dots are above the mean positions for a lot of those. But again, this is just to show you a distribution of how younger Americans fall out on the broader ideological landscape. And the clear takeaway here is that there's a fair amount of consensus around certain progressive ideas overall, and that the range of opinion is it's not as broad as it is among older people. Part of the reason the overall attitude supporting progressive positions in specific areas is the larger context of what they believe. Young people, the same with older voters, are in basic alignment with the idea in the first question here that the government should do more to promote the common good rather than doing more to promote individual liberty. That gives you sort of a macro sense of what people in this country believe should be done now. It seems quite consistent with what's going on. And at the same time, in the bottom statement pair, you'll see that young and older are in agreement that the government needs to play a larger role in the economy compared to those who say that turning to big government to solve our economic problems will do more harm than good. One of the more interesting ones, comparisons to older voters, is in the third statement here on the primacy of markets. And what you'll see, and it may be difficult to ascertain, so I'll just tell you here, the older cohort was more willing to say, although there were problems with the market economy, it's still the best way to organize the economy. A plurality of younger folks are actually quite critical of this and say that our current economic problems show what happens when you rely too much on the market and reduce regulations on corporations. So there's quite a difference of an opinion there, and I think that explains a lot of the aggregate progressivism we see throughout the survey. Now, what does all this mean? Well, not surprisingly, we see fairly high job performance ratings for President Obama. If you look across the top, we have the overall aggregate job approval rating for the president. It's quite high, 66% for the cohort overall, which is 10 points higher than those who are 30 or older. What's most interesting here is the conservative and the Republican column, where you have a plurality of young conservatives and young Republicans approving of the president's job performance to this date. In the national survey, this is dramatically reversed. There's a real hardening of opposition to the president among those who are 30 or older that we don't see among younger conservatives and Republicans themselves. Part of this has to do, and it's not to say that there won't be hardened opposition among young conservatives. We had an interesting question where we asked people to ascertain their own understanding of President Obama's ideological perspective. And what you get is this sort of a blank slate response where progressives, 60%, are more likely to say he's a progressive. 45% of liberals are likely to say he's a liberal. 38% of moderates will say he is a moderate, but in the last category, 52% of conservatives say he's a liberal. And this is a pattern that's repeated in the national survey. Again, the potential for some hardening of opposition and a belief among young conservatives that the president's agenda is broadly liberal in orientation. One of the more fascinating findings here is the overall skepticism and difficult position of the conservative brand at large. We asked people to rate, give a basic favorability rating towards major ideological perspectives, progressive, liberal, conservative, and libertarian. And if you look at the third column down, the third row down, you'll see that among all millennials, only 45% rate conservatism favorably. Now, this is a dramatic difference between those who are 30 and older, where, you know, more than two-thirds of people who are 30 or older give conservatism a positive rating. You'll notice here that progressivism or progressive approach to politics is rated highest among youngest folks. Liberal does quite well, does better than conservative. And continuing a trend we see in the national survey, there's very low favorability towards the libertarian brand, although we do find aspects of libertarian thinking among young people that are quite strong. You have a large percentage of people who cannot identify a libertarian perspective. This also happens in the among the older crowd. We've talked to our friends at Cato. We can imagine that they're going to try and do something about this over the next couple of years. But there is indication that libertarianism has a chance to rise somewhat with young people. And then finally, before I turn it over to Rui, there's a lot more data in here I'm not going to present at all, but let me just end on this one. The traditional ideological breakdown that's asked in most polling is a three-way question between liberal, moderate, and conservative. And with that, you usually get about one-fifth in the national population identifying as liberal, a large percentage moderate, and a fairly large percentage conservative. We decided to ask a five-point ideological breakdown because we think it's more consistent with the way people actually identify themselves. So we use liberal, progressive, moderate, conservative, and libertarian as the indicators. And what you'll see here on the graph on the left is that among millennials, you get 37% who identify as progressive or liberal. You get another 37% progressive liberal, 38% moderate or other, and about 25% conservative or libertarian. What we also know is that most people who are moderate in their orientation usually lean one way or another. So we ask people, you know, of the remaining ideological perspectives, which one would you be most likely to take on? And what you'll see is that there's basically a 16-point advantage for progressive liberal over conservative libertarian, 44-28, with a large percentage of younger folks staying steadfastly in the moderate or other category. So just let me sum up again briefly. The trends in the survey are very clear. I mean, generation progressive, that we might call it, is on the rise in this country, and it could seriously alter the balance of politics for years to come. This data is fairly consistent with other existing data, but we think it fleshes out in much greater detail the range and depth of millennial affinity for progressivism. I think it's going to have a powerful impact, and as Rui's going to tell you now, a lot of this can play out in terms of demographic shifts over the next 10 to 20 years. So I'll turn it over to Rui.
Yeah, thanks, John. Let's see.
You want this way?
No, I hate the clicker.
You hate the clicker?
So how do I get to, okay, here we go. Okay, so I'm going to say a few words, just hit the high points, really, of this report, New Progressive America, the Millennial Generation, that I just put out with David Madlin, a companion piece to the Youth Survey report that John was just talking about. We did consider calling it, Hey, How About Those Young People Today?, but we went with the boring title anyway. But let me just hit the high points for you. This may be familiar with you if there's a bit of data people know about the 2008 election and young voters. It's that 18 to 29-year-olds, all members of the millennial generation, which we define incidentally as those born between 1978 to 2000. That's our definition. There are others, but we're sticking to it. So 66-32 for 18 to 29-year-olds in 2008. That's pretty phenomenal. And that compares to 54-45 for Kerry in 2004 and only 48-46 for Gore in 2000. So steadily going up the ladder on the part of young people, and I don't think it's any coincidence that 2008 was the first election in which this age group was completely composed of members of the millennial generation. So, but there's a broader story. Whoops. There's a broader story behind the millennial generation. It's not just they voted for Obama. It's that they're profoundly progressive across a wide range of issues, as John has been alluding to, and they have big expectations for change in this country, and that's really going to transform the electorate as more and more of them go into the become part of the voting electorate as we move forward. Now, how many people is that, you ask? Well, there's your answer. It's going up from about 48 million eligible voters who are members of the millennial generation today to about 90 million by the year 2020, which will be the first presidential election in which all millennials will be part of the eligible electorate. So basically what that means is up until 2018, we're going to be adding about 4 million eligible millennial voters to the voting pool every year. Every year. So given their political behavior and their views, and I'll say a little bit more about that, that's a pretty profound change in the electorate. This is a little bit more information about just the size of the millennial generation. Maybe a little hard for you to read, but there's that figure, 90 million for the millennial eligible voters in 2020, and that's 39% in that year, in 2020, of the eligible voters in the entire country. So that's pretty impressive. There'll actually be even more members of the millennial generation who are adults. Some of them won't be able to vote. There'll be 103 million millennials who are part of the voting age population in the year 2020. So this is a kind of scale of this generation. This is a kind of impact that this generation is going to have moving forward. It's going to be immense. Now, one of the things that makes the impact of the millennial generation so profound, in addition to the fact it's just plain big, and we'll get to their views on things in just a second, is they're so diverse. This is the most diverse generation in U.S. history. As you can see there on the left-hand side, that's the data for 2009 among millennial adults, and it shows you that 40% of millennials are minorities at this point who are adults, and 60% are non-Hispanic whites. Now, if you go forward to 2020, this is something people aren't kind of tracking in on. Actually, the diversity of the millennial generation is just going to increase because the millennials who are not yet adults have a higher proportion of minorities than the millennials who are already adults. Plus, there's continuing impact from immigration of younger adults into this country. So by the time all the millennials are in the presidential electorate in 2020, 44% of millennials will be minorities. So that it's a little bit of a, and since millennials who are minorities tend to be much more progressive than other millennials, certainly much, much more progressive than the average voter in this country today, that's another part of how the millennial generation is going to make a big, is making and is going to continue to make a large impact on U.S. politics. So let's look at, given that diversity of the millennial generation, let's take a quick look at how millennials voted by race in the 2008 election. You can see incredibly overwhelming support from black millennials, 95-4, Hispanic millennials, 76-19 for Obama. And this is very significant among white millennials, 54-45 for Obama, in contrast to older white voters, among whom Obama lost by 15 points, I believe. Now, one thing that's really important about these data on white millennials is it was both white college-educated millennials, who we might expect from the tendency of white college-educated voters to move toward progressives and to support Obama much more than they've supported Democrats in the past. But what's interesting here is that white non-college or working class millennials also supported Obama in this election. That's a real profound shift. And we can take a look at our best way to compare white working class voters who are in the millennial generation is take a focus in on the 25 to 29-year-old age group, because then you don't have, in the 18 to 24-year-old age group, you have a fair amount of millennials who are on track to get a four-year college degree. They just haven't completed it yet. But in the 25, you look at the 25 to 29-year-old white non-college group, and you get a good sense of how white working class young people are looking at progressives and how they reacted to Obama in this last election. And you can see it's a profound shift. In 2004, Kerry lost this group by 28 percentage points. In 2008, Obama carried this group by 12 percentage points. So that's a 40-point swing toward progressives over the two elections. And the implications of this are pretty amazing for progressives, pretty terrible for conservatives. Because if you look at the sort of demographic distribution of voters and where the conservatives have been able to maintain support, it's really almost exclusively among white working-class voters. They carried them by 18 points in this last election. But it looks to be the case that given how progressive these younger millennial generation white working-class voters are, as more and more of them become part of the electorate and replace older white working-class voters, it raises the possibility that even the white working class can start to become much more accessible to progressive ideas and progressive candidates. And that's a really huge problem for the conservatives, given all the other demographic changes detailed in my previous report, which are putting them up against the wall, so to speak. Okay, well, one of the most profound things in terms of the views of the millennial generation that is important is their views on social issues. And this just shows some data on gay marriage from the Pew Center. And as you can see, millennials are 58 to 35 in favor of legalizing gay marriage. Among older generations, it's pretty much the reverse, 31 in favor, 60 opposed. There was some recent Washington Post data that showed the skew even higher. I believe you had 66% of 18 to 29-year-olds supporting gay marriage. This is a profound shift. Right now, support for gay marriage is increasing, I estimate, about 1 percentage point a year. If you just look at things in terms of generational replacement, if nothing else happens, views don't liberalize in any other way, just from more millennials becoming part of the adult population, we'll basically have a working majority, pretty solid majority for gay marriage at minimum by about, 2016, 2017, and it could easily come sooner than that. So one thing that tells you is that the culture wars as we understand them are probably coming to an end in the next period of time. These profound shifts in the demographic makeup of the electorate, of which the rise of the millennial generation is crucial, are really taking the ground out from under the material basis of the culture war. So just in the future, there just aren't going to be enough people who care strongly enough about fighting these issues to really affect their politics. Cultural conflicts will not disappear, but they will be mitigated to the point where I think their ability to make a big impact on our politics is going to be seriously compromised. Again, this is kind of a bad thing for the conservatives, kind of a good thing for progressives, because we'd rather see tolerance sort of reign everywhere and argue about the interesting and important stuff about, not that that stuff isn't important, but where is our country going? You know, what is the economy going to be like? What should be the role of government? Well, funny you should mention the role of government, because millennials, as I think John was alluding to, are exceptionally, and this is data is even somewhat stronger than in our survey, are exceptionally likely to back an active and large role for government. This is data from the 2008 exit polls. You've got a 69-27 majority saying government should do more to solve problems in this country rather than government does too much left to businesses and individuals. Among all voters, it was much more closely split, 50 to 43, and you find this in a wide range of questions about the role of government today. And now that spills over into a variety of specific issues that millennials want action on. It spills over to the question of universal health care, to the question of the transition to clean energy, to the question of how much we should invest in our educational system and how much, and so on and so forth. Down the line, millennials are very solidly in favor of a pretty strong government role in moving these changes in our country forward. Now, you may ask, I hear you asking it right now, that, well, what about when they get older? I mean, aren't they just going to become conservative? Aren't they going to, they're going to get married, they'll have kids, they'll pay taxes. You know, by that time, all this stuff will disappear. Well, we don't think so. I mean, our analysis suggests that, first of all, the whole concept that people's ideas change that radically as they get older is quite flawed. There are, in fact, many things that are quite sticky. People's party identification is very sticky. People's views on social issues, like gays' right to marry and a wide range of other things, very sticky. They don't change. And even, it turns out, their views on the role of government, their views on a specific issue like universal health care, they may change some, but they don't change that much. And what are millennials' views on universal health care? Well, it turns out they're the most progressive generation ever on universal health care. These are some data from the National Election Study that show the right-hand column is 2008, and the red bar in that cluster
is 18 to 29-year-old support for universal health care. As you can see, it's higher than any other bar in that chart. What that's telling you is that, and this is consistent with a lot of other data we have, that members of the millennial generation are particularly strong on the need for universal health care and particularly interested in seeing sort of substantial and aggressive action taken to meet that goal. Again, that's just one example of a policy issue they lean progressive on and care a great deal about, but it's a very important one. And by these data and by other data we looked at, we don't think those views are going to disappear over time. They're going to stay with us, and it's going to have a big effect on our electorate moving forward. And I think that's all the slides I have for you today, kids. So I think we'll just get to our discussants.
Yeah, if we could invite Abby and Erica up, and they're gonna provide some context, challenge the reports, offer any sorts of ideas from their own research about the two reports that were just released. And so we thank them, and I think Abby's gonna go first. Is your mic working?
I hope it is.
Yeah, there we go.
Can people hear? Okay. Well, first of all, I just want to say thanks for inviting Circle to be here. I'm really thrilled about this new research. The detail about talking about youth political ideology and the possibility of a new trend line is very exciting for us research geeks. To make my comments a little bit more practical, I want to kind of pose a question that'll frame what I'm going to say. So thinking about 2008 and the future elections and kind of solidifying the youth vote long term, kind of thinking about it that way, is solidifying the youth vote in the long term about persuasion or is it about mobilization? Is it about persuading people to vote in a particular way or just getting people to vote, you know, who you kind of know are going to vote in a particular way? So there's a few ways in which I want to start talking about this. The survey that John was talking about kind of indicates that because the youth generation is particularly progressive, that mobilization is particularly important. And so I think that there's more to say about that, though, because as Rui just suggested, that young people's kind of progressivism is going to stay over the long term. That's actually something that we've found as well, kind of solidifying this idea that mobilization is important. We've been looking at Circle. We've been looking at generations over time. And so we've been looking at both public opinion data and kind of self-reported ideology over the past 40 years and looking at how that does or doesn't change as a, you know, particular generation grows older. And what you, when you step back and you look at the millennials as compared to previous generations, they're actually, as Rui has said, just, you know, from other data, reinforcing what he said, the most progressive yet. In fact, even more progressive than those liberal 60s hippies. And so what we, it is kind of surprising, I mean, to some extent. So what we do know from this long-term analysis is that these progressive leanings are not likely to go away. And that they, what we think, highlight a cohort effect with young people. So when we were looking at the data, we were looking for potentially three different things. Whether or not it was just age, whether or not it was, you know, particularly this point in history, or whether or not this particular cohort of young people are gonna stay more progressive as they grow older. And what we find is that it's not merely going to be about age, that this is going to be a generation that retains its kind of progressive streak as they grow older, as Generation X has retained their conservative streak, as John suggested. So kind of thinking about that reinforces the mobilization kind of idea over persuasion. But I think that there's a little bit more to say about mobilization. And this is something that we've been tossing around a little bit at Circle. Another theory that I just want to throw out there is that this particular election was very much about mobilization because conservative and Republican youth actually stayed home and did not vote. So we've been trying to figure out how to understand more about this, how to think about this particular theory. And to be honest, it's been a little bit difficult, in terms of available data. But one way in which we've kind of tried to gain a little slice of insight into this and is by looking at state youth voter turnout. I guess this isn't clearly proving this theory and certainly isn't causally proving this theory. But when you look at state voter turnout and whether or not it's the youth vote has kind of gone red or gone blue, if you will, there's 11 states where over the past 5 elections, in 4 out of the past 5, at least 4, I should say, some there are 5 out of 5, there's 11 states where the youth vote has gone red. But in the 2008 election, 7 out of these 11 states, the youth vote went down. In 1 state, it didn't change. But in 6 out of 11, it actually went down, in 2 states by kind of a considerable amount. So I think that this also plays in some small part in arguing that mobilization is particularly key to kind of solidifying the youth vote for a particular kind of party or campaign over the long term. But at the same time, I think that there's also information that points to the fact that persuasion may still be possible. And one of the things that struck me about the ideology report that John was talking about that I find really, really interesting is that there's a number of people in the ideology survey who actually answered 5. They answered neutral. So when you look at the questions that are on the second page, I think it's 22 through 40, there's a lot of young people, almost a third, I think, in one of the indicators, 40%, who say that they're right in the middle, they're neutral. They kind of don't want to go either way. This may be evidence that young people are still trying to figure out what they think about a lot of things and are open to influence or persuasion strategies, if you will. This is actually supported by recent circle analysis that young people's experiences, particularly in their 20s, have very much been changing. The marriage rate is down. I think that the reports show this. The experience of entering the workforce is very different, and that people are less likely to sort of leave home en masse at a particular certain age, or leave home and come back, I think, in some cases. But what I think these things point to is that it means that there's less opportunity for this generation, or maybe different, I think you could also argue, less opportunity compared to older generations to learn about public issues and engage in civic life at this age than older cohorts. We also found this to be the case with college students. We did focus groups with college students all over the country, and what we found actually was that for this particular group of college students, who are the most likely of young people at their particular age to have had civic learning opportunities, that they are very much trying to figure things out for themselves too. So on top of potentially being evidence that there are youth out there who, you know, have yet to settle into an ideological perspective, this may also be just one more reason, I think, why civic programs for young people and civic education in schools is needed even more at this time. And I think this would especially be the case for young people who are not connected to institutions like, you know, particular community groups or colleges or unions. So if we're going to talk about bringing a new generation into civic and political life, we need to talk about the experiences of all young people, and we need to talk about giving them the knowledge, access, and resources to do that. So going back to this question about the long-term kind of stances of the youth vote, just for the sake of discussion, I think added together, these points could make an argument for the fact that President Obama won the election via mobilization by turning out a progressive youth base. That would mean that conservative or potentially libertarian candidates might have the opportunity to move some not yet committed young people to the right and turn out more of their own particular youth base.
We'll talk. I'd like to address some of the things you raised. Those are excellent points. But first, we'll hear from Erica.
Well, thank you for having me. And unlike Abby and Rui and John, I am not a research geek. I'm much more of a people geek. I find it really intriguing and interesting to be able to take this analysis and this research and kind of apply it to my own, I guess, anecdotal evidence. And what this does is it supports that. It supports the experiences that I've had in the field, the experiences that we've had here at Campus Progress, that our partner organizations have had, that we see talking to young people on colleges and campuses across the country, in neighborhoods. We're hearing that young people ideologically are very progressive, right? So these research and findings support that. But what does that mean? If I'm talking to a young person, I'm not going to pull up a bunch of research and statistics, right? I'm going to talk a little bit more about what does this mean daily? What does this mean when you interact with people on a daily basis? And what does this mean outside of electoral politics for actual policy? What are the policy implications? And so number one, the reason I love this is because it tells a story. If you look at it first, it says that there's a generation of people who have a shared set of values. What are those values? They are peace. They're economic opportunity. They're equality. They are social justice. They're religious plurality. There's a set of values that traditionally we think are American values, right? They're part of, I guess, the fabric, if you will, of what has made America, America. But what's unique about it is that this generation has a shared experience that shapes how we view those values, how we see the implementation of those values. And most importantly, our shared experience makes us understand that there's something we haven't done in the past 8 years, in the past decade, to help us live up to those values. And we're rigorously solution-oriented. That's what I love about this document. It shows us that not only are young people pie in the sky, we want equality, we want justice, we want freedom, we want religious plurality, but there are clear policy implications to that. And young people have been working on those implications before the election, and I'm proud to say are continuing to do that after the election. So that's one thing. I wanted to highlight the story that this tells so that we can bring it down to everyday people. And the important part of that is, will millennials stay progressive? Because of that shared experience, this research says that yes, we will stay progressive. I love Abby's question about whether or not the electoral strategy right from now on should be more about mobilization and about persuasion. And I don't think it's an either or. I actually think it's very clearly it needs to be about both. Because yes, we'll need to continue to mobilize young people who have expressed these values, but have not yet connected these values and these core beliefs with the impact of voting. A lot of young people do agree and believe that these are things and ideals we should live up to, but do not see the correlation, and for good cause and for good reason sometimes, between those beliefs, ideals, and values and actually voting. So I think that's a piece of mobilization that's very important. And then yes, I do want to get the other percentage that they're not progressive yet, but I think they will be. The report also raised, though, I think, more importantly, some really serious questions and concerns that I want to make sure we address, if not in this room, especially for those of us who are working to organize young people and work on youth political engagement and empowerment. And I want us to be able to read a little bit beneath the surface of some of these statements. If young people are progressive, one of the things, I don't know if people in the room have actually been able to read the full report yet, I know you've got the summary here, but some of the questions get a little hairy and a little fuzzy when we're talking about race and gender and the implications for that aspect of social policy, right? And the implications for that on our social values, and what does that mean? There was a phrase in the report that talked about being a post-racial generation and how race isn't that much, or I think it was, is a non-issue now for a lot of millennials. And that is, at the same time, heartening, very disheartening. Right? If we're going to be honest about it, because what we're talking about is the most diverse generation in history. So it says that we have an appreciation for diversity. We love it. We understand it. We see it. We realize the value for it. But here's the concern. Do we see a connection then between that and the need for policies that will make that happen? And that's the concern, because conservatives have actually pretty successfully, if we're looking at the state level, the attacks on equal opportunity programming and affirmative action, conservatives have used that same rhetoric to pull away those programs and said, well, let's be race neutral. Let's be gender neutral. Let's be race and gender blind. And what happens? The programs are removed. Programs that were put in place and some people think are the vestiges of old ways of viewing these identities and structures, but in fact have helped us become the most diverse generation that we are. So I think there's some serious implications here for how we talk about these issues and how we connect them, the values, to the actual policy outcomes.
That's great. Thank you both. It's great insight, and it's always useful to have alternative perspectives and different views on the work you're doing. What's interesting when you talk about the question of persuasion and mobilization and connecting it to your idea of a shared experience is that the persuasion goes both ways. So let's say President Obama and progressives writ large, they have as much persuading to do as conservatives do. So on a lot of these issues that you correctly point to where folks are quite ambivalent on limited government, deficits, other things like this, progressives haven't sealed the deal yet. None of this stuff is automatic or assured. We talk about this a fair amount. Even though the trends are pretty clear, this is a real moment to solidify, and I think the word is deliver. And if you don't deliver, there's a real opportunity in more than those 11 states that went red for things to change pretty dramatically. And I think, to the extent that the shared attitude that you talk about, the shared worldview and experience and the solution-oriented impact of young people sticks and the solutions lead to a better condition for younger Americans in many ways, you might see a long-term solidification of a new progressive majority. But to the extent it doesn't happen, it could possibly go the other way. If you want to add anything.
I agree with that. I mean, I think that's absolutely right. If you don't actually deliver on these things that young people are interested in, obviously they're already existing suspicions, let's face it, about government and its role. I mean, not everything's peaches and cream in terms of people's views. There's a lot of cynicism out there, actually, about young people, about the politicians that are around today and the things that government has done. I mean, that's different from their feelings about the potential for government, which are quite strong and quite positive. But when they look at the politicians out there, with some exceptions, they look at government institutions, they think, they're not up to snuff, they're self-interested, they're out to line their own pockets, and so on. So failures of government at this point to deliver on the things that at this point it says it's going to do could loom pretty large in the consciousness of millennials, and including perhaps especially the millennials who aren't part of the electorate yet, who are just coming online, so to speak. If their experience of government is failure as they become voting adults, that has big implications for the politics of this generation going forward.
Great. I'd like to turn it over to audience questions now. So if you have a question, please raise your hand, and we'll have a microphone brought over. If you wouldn't mind just stating your name, institutional affiliation, if you feel like it, and please keep your questions fairly brief, and if you can, try and direct it to somebody up here. So we'll start in the back and move forward. Sure. Thank you. Yeah, thank you. Those are good questions. I'll take the first one. I'm going to ask Rui to take the second one. If there's any evidence that the GOP is behaving like the Tories, it's non-existent. You can't see it anywhere. The sort of progressive conservatism of the Tory party is non-existent in the modern GOP. In fact, if you look at the attempts to try and revise or reorient the modern Republican Party that have come up recently, they've come under dramatic attack from the right wing of the Republican Party. I think it will potentially take analytically a period of time in the wilderness before you get the ideas of Ross Douthat or Michael Garrison or David Frum, who tend to lean a little more on reform-oriented ideas, to take hold within that party. But it's not to say you are correct. The other part of the rise of the Tories in the UK, of course, is the perception of the failure of the Labour Party. And if the Democratic Party is perceived to fall flat on numerous fronts, and the GOP is able to moderate some of its public face, and so it's not Rush Limbaugh or Michael Savage or other folks like that, it's certainly possible that things could change. I mean, again, we make the claim, we look at the long-term data, politics still matters tremendously in this country, and it can shift. So,
on the question of whether the millennial generation will stay progressive on, I guess, broadly speaking, economic issues, the role of government, you might have talked to Scott Keeter over at Pew. I don't know. Scott's a friend of mine, and I have a lot of respect for his work, but I kind of respectfully disagree on this particular issue. I think Scott and I both agree that if you look at social issues, attitudes toward religion, and other things like that, those things are very sticky and they don't hardly change at all. Now, if you look at attitudes toward the role of government, they're depending on the question, and it is depending on the question, there are some life cycle effects. You start out at a certain level and then maybe some decay over time. But one thing to think about in terms of that is if young people coming into the electorate today in this generation are very unusually progressive on the role of government, even if there's some decay over time as they get older, they're starting from a higher base. So even if they go down a little bit, they're still going to be substantially more progressive than members of other generations. So that's one thing to keep in mind. And then another issue was, well, how much is that? How big is that decay? How big is that life cycle effect? And my view is it's actually can be exaggerated, that in fact it's less than people tend to think, that people's views were in their 20s about the role of government. There is a substantial amount of stickiness over time. So that's that's my view. Scott may have a different view. I think he does. But, that's my story, and I'm sticking to it.
Do you all want to add anything?
I mean, on the first question about the Republican Party versus the Democratic Party, again, not a research geek, but I would love to know if there is research that supports this anecdotal evidence that the young people, at least that we work with, don't care about party identity. It's much more, and that's why I think we tend to use the term progressive much more, not only for legal reasons, but than we would ever, even interacting with young people on a daily basis, use the term Democrat, because of that cynicism of government, there is not as much support for traditional party politics. So I don't make the assumption that this data supports, some sort of Democratic shift over the long haul. If that happens, great. If it doesn't, great. I think the point is about the progressive ideals, and whichever party is able to substantially support those, that is where we'll see ourselves lining up with.
Jim Lowen, I'm a sociologist. I wrote the book Sundown Towns. In the early 1980s, I worked at the University of Vermont, and I had the interesting experience of repeatedly interviewing voters in Burlington and around there who voted for Bernie Sanders for mayor in one election, then Ronald Reagan, then Sanders for Congress the next, and then Ronald Reagan again. And that caused me to think about what's the consistency between those two folks. And there is one. And I think what it is that they both said what they were going to do and kind of did it. And I think the weakness of the Democratic Party politicians has been that they are very nebulous when they say what they're going to do, typically. And so I'm wondering, right now you're having the wonderful, enjoyable experience of doing these polls in an atmosphere where there's no significant Republican leadership. But if the Newt Gingrich of 1994, I think it was, comes back, I don't mean that guy, but somebody like him, who says what he or she is going to do in a believable way, don't you worry that this progressive opening will be lost because so many Democratic politicians don't counter with a direct statement like that?
It's certainly, I mean, it's certainly a possibility. I mean, nobody makes any claims that Congress...
didn't we write something about this?
Yeah, we did write something about this. In broad agreement in your notion that you need to have more politics based on principle in many ways. But the thing you seem to overlooking here is that what you talked about with Sanders and Reagan, which is a sense of authenticity and standing with, you know, your core principles, whatever they may be, is how a lot of people, in many ways, view Obama. Now, it may be a little more nebulous. They may be a little more confused of the exact philosophy behind it, but they believe he's straightforward and honest and represents some kind of new, significant new direction. So he, regardless of what goes on the other side, President Obama's political image may be the dominant one for the short term, which may mitigate some of this. But certainly, I think the congressional parties on both sides have a lot to do in terms of refining their perception and publicity among the public. I don't know if anybody else. Next, this gentleman over here. Take a few more questions here. Over this gentleman over here. Yeah, thank you. Thanks, Vincent.
Hi, thanks. Michael Robbins at the Seed Foundation. I had an opportunity to work with Mark Lopez at Circle many years ago, and speaking about the difficulties with some of these data sets, I did some work looking at sort of progressive views and civic efficacy and youth voting and volunteering, had some theories around civic efficacy and progressive views. Unfortunately, at the time, the data sets were just getting underway, and I'm wondering, is Circle or anyone else looking comprehensively at this issue from a research perspective?
Specifically, do you mean trying to connect ideology and efficacy?
Yeah, and trying to measure civic efficacy in the millennial generation. I was trying to look at the types, at both volunteering rates and the kinds of volunteering. I mean, what I think we are seeing right now is civic interest and volunteering, mm-hmm. which is sort of single-time volunteering, which is more sort of feel-good volunteering than actual socially connected volunteering and commitment. And, my theory was that, there tends to be a lack of belief that by engaging in public processes, you can actually solve problems. I'm wondering if we're seeing changes in that, who's doing this research. I would love to see American Progress take this issue on.
Let Abby answer this.
Yeah, I think that you are honing in on something that's significantly important relative to young people and talking about civic efficacy. And who's measuring it is a great question. We're very much trying to look at that particular issue with respect to young people who do not have college experience, because there is largely what some people call a civic empowerment or civic achievement gap with respect to education that is quite pronounced and very pronounced in the voter turnout in the 2008 election. I think that this is going to be really important to look at kind of longitudinally as much as possible. And while I do think that volunteering is the sort of high rates of volunteering of millennials is really contributing to some sort of kind of feeling of civic efficacy, the quality of those programs are so drastically different that trying to make some generalization about all volunteering like that I think is really incorrect. But on another note, I think that kind of looking at millennials long term is that there's probably a lot of people who got their feet wet in the 08 election. And what happens with that is going to be really, really interesting. So, I don't have a firm answer to your question. I just want to reinforce that we definitely think it's really important.
We only have a few minutes left, so what I want to do is gather two or three questions from up front here, and we'll try and address them all at once if that's possible. So let's go one, two, three.
Michael Glassman from the American Israel Public Affairs Committee. Mm-hmm. You talked about this being a very solution-oriented generation, and then I think Ruiz said something about being very cynical about politicians. So I'm wondering, what percentage or how much of this generation is is that finds that solution through politics and run, meaning running for office or things beyond just voting in the polls.
Okay, thank you. And I'm just going to gather the questions up real quick. Oh. Why don't you go ahead, and then you can go next, sir, since you're already up.
Hi, my name is Julie Chen, and I'm originally from Maui, Hawaii, transferring my school to DC campus, American University. But I'm the one tangibly have evidence that I was volunteering, writing that comprehensive immigration bill to mm-hmm. the Bush White House. And then Congress had failed. But when I ride a bus and my gathering around me, that I see lots of Hispanics and mm-hmm. other minorities growing as a big powerful part of voting group. So I think it's inevitable to change, I mean, the help this, it's a huge, also as a very huge social problem like Medicare and immigration law.
Okay.
And I, 2007, it's so sadly they failed. Instead, they passed it, then I would have had, you know, interview by the CNN and also MSNBC and all that, but it didn't happen. But hopefully,
okay.
either party can see this problem and solve it, have a solution.
No, that's an excellent point, and thank you. We just want to grab one more question up here.
The sample that you used for this research, I was just wondering exactly who all was involved and
yep.
how many, and what you are defining in your research as progressive.
Uh-huh. And this gentleman was up. I've got to let him ask the question.
Sort of the same question that she had basically, and also why it was that 85% of self-identified progressives have progressive.
That's pretty high, actually. That's a pretty, yeah, I mean, it could be a little bit higher, but that anything above 80 is pretty high. But this was a large scale. There was a national sample of 1,400 randomly selected adults, 18 and older. It was done through a hybrid methodology. That's pretty much the norm today. So those who have landline phones only, a mix of cell phone and landlines and cell phone only. We augmented this with an online survey of younger people. So we have a mix of both phone calls and online surveys for the younger population. The total sample size for the millennials was 915. The total sample size for the national survey was 1,400. So the margin of error on the youth survey is about 3.2%. That should answer that question. The solutions through running. Erica, you want to take that one?
I'm wondering if Abby has actually done any research on that. Again, my analysis would be anecdotal, and I think it's increasing, similar to what Abby said, increasing, and it'll be interesting to watch after the 2008 election, which was the time where a lot of millennials actually did get their feet wet in the electoral process. And so I think looking at how many of those young people will remain engaged through traditional political activities, I think remains to be seen.
Just really quickly, college students, right, who have the most kind of civic learning opportunities based on research, who I guess are the most likely to kind of buy into the system in some ways. Through our focus groups, we're a little bit torn and wanted to see the political system as a place where solutions can happen and where change can happen, but we're a little bit ambivalent about it. So that's where I think the volunteering comes in to some extent, where people can see in some ways what some people would call solutions. So I think, as Erica has suggested, has been really interesting. It should be interesting to see what happens.
And we have the Center for American Progress is deeply involved in work on comprehensive immigration reform. I'd be happy
to give
you.
There's some data in the Madeline Teixeira report about
that
millennials'
issue.
Attitudes toward immigration reform, and actually millennials are unusually supportive of comprehensive immigration reform and generally much more favorable toward immigrants and immigration than older generations. So this is yet another way in which the increasing influence of millennials in the electorate is going to mitigate these conflicts around immigration reform and probably help build support for it over the long haul. So So I think there's grounds for optimism there.
I'm sorry we have to stop the formal program at this point because we're run over time. I encourage anybody to come up and talk to us afterwards, but we are stopping the formal program now. I want to thank Erica and Abby and Rui, and thank you all for coming. So.